How many Patagonia products do you two own?
Zero.
Zero?
Yeah.
No way, Franz.
Yep. I'm like, my apparel closet is still full of Adidas. I told this story a few times and it still lasts.
You cut this man, he bleeds three stripes. I mean, if you've been listening to this podcast for a while, you'll know any excuse to bring up his love of Adidas. I admire the fact that you are not replacing that stuff until it expires, which is a very relevant message that we'll get into later.
Exactly. I think Patagonia would be happy with your approach, Franz.
Yeah, and I think they would even repair my stuff.
They might. Yeah.
They might.
The stripe needs just sewn back on again, guys. I don't own any either.
Well, I must say that I'm surprised.
I have alternative kind of brands in a similar sphere, I guess, that I've ended up buying, but been very close. I did buy one of their bags once, but it wasn't for me, so it went back.
Okay. Alrighty.
How about you, Alan?
I have three or four.
Just three or four.
Yeah.
One is a vest.
Sorry?
One is a vest.
Oh, actually, then it's five. Yeah. Yeah. So, everyone, welcome to another Business Design Teardown, where we look into the darlings of the design community, companies and products that we designers love, to find out if they're only good in design aspect or if they're good in business aspect as well. My name is Alan and I'm the founder of the DMBA.
I'm Franz and I'm the program director of the DMBA.
And I'm Tom. I'm an independent product designer and design strategist, co-host of this podcast, but also host of the DMBA live events series, of which we have got one coming up very, very soon.
We are.
But actually tomorrow, if our publishing schedule has gone to plan. So we are hosting a free live event with the wonderful Maureen Herbin on Wednesday, the 17th of April, 2024, 6 p.m. Central European Time, 12 Eastern. And that is all about presenting design work to stakeholders. Absolutely something that I think a lot of us constantly trying to get better at. How do we articulate the value of the work that we are doing? How do we connect design back to business outcomes? All that good stuff. And Maureen is just the perfect person to take us on that journey. So if that sounds like your cup of tea, absolutely should. Sign up to get your ticket at d.mba/webinars. I've got that right, haven't I?
You have.
I have. Good. You'll find the information about the event on there. There's a page all about it. Quick sign up form, and we will send you all the details of how to join. And look forward to seeing plenty of you there. If you like any of the look of any of the previous events we've done, you can watch those as well. Their recordings are all there on that webinars page. But yes, back to today's episode. So we have chosen to tear down Patagonia, even though Franz and I don't own any of their stuff. We thought, how could
actually,
we not?
Actually, that's not true. You do own one true Patagonia product,
do
right?
I own one Patagonia product.
I'm holding it up.
Reveal this
come,
now.
Come. Yeah. Join us.
If you're watching YouTube, you see three lads holding three books into the camera, and these three books are called Let My People Go Surfing.
The Education of a Reluctant Businessman, which is something I'm going to touch on shortly, which is a book by Yvon Chouinard. I think I've pronounced that well, which isn't usually my strong suit. All about his philosophies on business and building Patagonia, apparently, because I'm ashamed to say that I've had this book on my bookshelf for a while and still haven't actually fully read it. Whereas Alan has got notes in the margins highlighted all over it. So maybe you can give us a little rundown of it later on, Alan.
Yeah, I mean, think the whole podcast will be some kind of a rundown of this book. Alan and me, we have read it, and we do want to believe that we use some of the stuff, but let's not go into that.
Let's get into that in a bit. So, okay, I do own one Patagonia product, So yeah, I stand corrected. Okay, so yes, why do we choose them? Like we say, been on our to-do list for a long time. It kind of felt like a bit too obvious. We're like, really, Patagonia? And then recently we were like, ah, damn it, let's do it. And it has been a fascinating one to dive into again. And it feels like it's in our sweet spot. Designers tend to care about, I think, care about sustainability, doing the right thing. I think we pride ourselves on that, particularly in kind of UX and service design world. And there's few brands that live this philosophy quite like Patagonia. So there's that aspect to it. But I think there's also the fact that Patagonia and some very specific products kind of invaded the tech world for a while there, maybe 10 years ago, where the fleece vest became like the uniform of like product managers and founders in Silicon Valley, but also in finance world as well. Hilariously nicknamed the success vest, which I absolutely loved. But it kind of became this uniform in the tech world, which again, I think just made Patagonia even more well-known in our space. Patagucci, as they started to get known as around that time as well.
The even so, worse one is Fratagonia.
Oh, Fratagonia, jeez. Honestly, that's it all problem. Makes my skin crawl. I have to say, might be one of the reasons I haven't brought any Patagonia stuff. But I feel like that era has thankfully passed a little bit. But there's a lot to admire. And a lot of elements to the story and the products, I think, align with the sensibilities of designers. But what are these products that we're talking about? What did Patagonia produce that means we're featuring them today? So brief overview of their sort of current brand, their product range. In general, broadly, this is high quality, thoughtfully designed, durable, repairable outdoor apparel and equipment with a very high attention to detail. Now, they're not the only people that fit that mold, but there are certain elements of that mix that they really over-index on, particularly around sustainability, repairability, and quality, which we will be diving into. But a brief overview, we're talking about apparel, we're talking about outdoor clothing like base layers, waterproofs, shells, all that good stuff to keep you dry and ideally at a good temperature when you're halfway up a mountain or going to get your flat white in San Jose. And then there's like sports specific gear, specialized stuff for climbing, skiing, snowboarding. So they do sort of niche down in certain areas and do like clothing and apparel that's specific to those people. And then there's the casual stuff, the tees, the fleeces, the hats. They're probably more appropriate to the majority of us. Maybe not Franz. Franz is up a mountain every weekend, so he probably would benefit from some of this. And then there's the gear, the bags, the packs, backpacks, camping stuff like sleeping bags and accessories, water bottles. So, you know, pretty broad mix, but I'd say most of the focus is on that good, high quality technical apparel. So that's what we're talking about. Worth a quick browse on the website if you want to familiarize yourself before getting into the next part of the podcast. But they have also expanded into some other areas which we'll touch on, particularly around secondhand goods, repaired goods, which is again sort of indexing on that sustainability element. They've now got a what they call Patagonia Provisions, where you can buy food stuff like jerky and like packaged dried salmon and stuff that you might take out camping with you, but also like stuff like pasta and all sorts. So yeah, interesting move for them. And then Patagonia Books. This was not published by Patagonia Books, Let My People Go Surfing, just FYI. This is a Penguin release, but they now have their own publishing house as well. Needless to say, that's a smaller element. So that's the stuff. There's a lot of stuff, ironically, for a sustainable brand. But why is Patagonia such an interesting company for designers to dive into? Side note, there's an awful lot that I think designers will find fascinating about Patagonia. Hopefully today we will pique your interest. We could do a whole series, to be fair, on all of this stuff, but we'll try and keep it short and sweet. For me, the three reasons from doing all my research that designers, I think, and personally, I admire Patagonia, are these. The first of those is their ability to use emotional design to connect with consumers. And big hat tip to Kelly Jones, who did a great article on LinkedIn all about how Patagonia managed this in so many elements of like connecting emotionally to us. And that's through things like their choice of imagery, very evocative photography, filmmaking, all about the great outdoors, about embracing the wild, but also about sustainability as well. And that element comes into like the storytelling piece as well, which is a real art form that they've absolutely nailed. It feels very authentic.
This is actually mentioned in the book. So like in one of the chapters called Marketing Philosophy, the founder talks about this being a very conscious decision. So way back when they started, most of the companies in this space, the way they were presenting their product was, well, by presenting their products. So you would take a photo of a t-shirt, pullover, jacket, you know, there would be no person wearing it. So just a photo of that product with a description, functional description.
Mm.
And what Patagonia revolutionized or created in this space was kind of the context. So they wouldn't just use a image of a product, where they would take an image of an emotional moment of a person that is outdoors wearing obviously a Patagonia product, but that would be the image. You know, we're not selling you the product, we're selling you this experience, that moment. Yeah. And that was a huge innovation, and now obviously everybody's doing it because it's working, but that was at the time a huge thing, because that's also back in the time, it was mostly catalog sales. So these companies would send you catalogs, and there would be just, you know, a list of products. And then they shifted the model with this as well.
Isn't this exactly what Patagonia, at least that's how I remember it, what Patagonia invented, that catalog that is actually telling stories?
Correct. So, yeah, they still use the catalog, but it was not done in the same way like... what we have in what I have in mind when I think of the catalog.
Yeah, just product side by side instead of stories. Actually, a magazine that would also sell you some stuff.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this way of connecting storytelling to sales, let's be honest, this has become something that's become increasingly popular move, which we'll get into in a bit more detail. They're not the only people now doing this, particularly in the kind of high-end outdoor space. Yep. But yeah, that emotional connection, they really managed to nail it and make it feel very authentic. Second thing I think is fascinating from a design perspective is this intentionally restrictive design philosophy. And what do I mean by that? Well, Patagonia, they intentionally limit, for example, the materials that they use. They work with a very, very narrow range of actual materials compared to a lot of other brands. Those materials have to fit with their sustainability beliefs, so the way they're produced, the way that they are going to be long-lasting, the way that dyes are used, all that kind of stuff. And it also allows them to have less waste in the process. So, as a designer, knowing that, okay, I need to work with just this one particular type of material is like such an interesting design constraint to start off with. It's not the only limitation they have, but there are other restrictive elements around like utilitarianism. So whatever we design, first and foremost, has to work very well. Fashion and look is kind of secondary. It needs to work extremely well. And if people like the aesthetic that comes alongside that, then great. But if it doesn't function, then it fails. So usefulness is higher priority than simplicity or minimalism or fashion. And those constraints are incredibly empowering for any designer. And I love the way that they absolutely stick to their guns on that. And that if you're a designer at Patagonia, you kind of live those and you understand that comes with the territory of designing for Patagonia. Because constraints for me are empowering. It really reminded me of this David Ogilvy quote, give me the freedom of a tight brief. It makes you such a more effective person if you know what the limitations are you're working around. Really powerful thing for other designers to think about, like what limitations can I give myself to have super focus?
Mm. best innovation projects I ever had were the ones with the tightest defined constraints in the very beginning. Was super weird for most of the teams, but when there's like an open brief and you feel like, wow, great, everything is possible, this was setting up everybody for failure because no definition of what makes one happy, no definition, no opportunity to break a barrier because everything is possible. So that's really spot on.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I always try and find the constraints when I'm working on a new design project. And so an example of this would be, okay, we are limited on materials. We also know that one of our pillars is replaceability, sustainability. That changes why how you approach something like how a zipper is going to be designed. So shout out to Futureproof YouTube channel, which is fantastic, does a lot of kind of brand focused kind of videos. Did one on Patagonia and talked about the fact that the zipper that Patagonia use when they're designing that, it needs to be easily removable and replaceable. So that constraint makes you think, okay, it's not going to be the most minimal thing in the world. There's probably going to be some threading showing, or the way that this is taken, the way this is constructed needs to be constructed in a way that it can be taken off very easily. And other brands won't be thinking about that. Other designers won't have to work with that constraint. And I absolutely admire and would love to work with more companies that give you these kind of very clear parameters. I think that's a real luxury as a designer. Third thing for me, final thing, and it's going back to this book, is a very relatable, it seems odd when you think about how insane the story of Patagonia is, but to me, a very relatable founder as a designer. He is a reluctant business person. And I think so many designers feel this way. I know we come up against this when we talk to people about DMBA and talk about the importance of business knowledge, of like people worry they're going to be giving up their user-centric, humanities forward sensibilities to be good in business. And we always say you don't need to do that. And I think that's a real pain barrier for people to get over. But Yvonne, he shows us that it can be done. I mean, the guy's built an absolutely enormous empire doing good along the way. But he is reluctant in being referred to as a business person. He really pushes back on that. And he has tried to rewrite the rules of capitalism and how you can do business. And I think for a designer and as a design community where we have that reluctance, it's kind of a chap that shows you can maintain the sensibilities, the ethics, the beliefs you want, and be a great business person as well. And ultimately, saw this quote recently where he said, "What he wants to influence is a new form of capitalism that doesn't end up with a few rich people and a bunch of poor people." And I think, I certainly in my sphere of design, a lot of designers feel very uncomfortable about the capitalism elements. Have a look into what Yvonne is trying to do to change things and you might feel inspired. So those are my top three reasons. I had just one final like side point, which is I read this interview with Miles Johnson, who's the senior creative director. And I really, again, liked this kind of way they pose design problems to their teams. And this is a direct quote from an interview where he said, "When our designers work on a new style, I often ask to see two options. One that raises the bar, surprises, invigorates, inspires. And a second version has only to be straightforward to perfectly fulfill its intended purpose. Next, we'll ask the question, does it have to be one or the other? Are there elements of both that will create an original, exceptional product that's best in class?" And I just thought, what a wonderful kind of experiment to take into every piece of design work you do. And this is one that I'm going to start playing with a bit more in my own work. So yeah, lots of very inspiring stuff in there for designers. A lot in this story to be taking into our own work, I think. So yeah. And what a story it's been. But yeah, how did this story all start?
Yeah, I'm going to go back to the almost unpronounceable Yvonne Chouinard. Hope that's okay for you, Yvonne, if you're listening to this. Yeah, I mean, unrelatable or very relatable, as you said. Just to use his words, he says, "I am a dirtbag. I was a dirtbag." And actually, it's almost hard to imagine. Like, he lived in his car. He camped for weeks in the Yosemite National Park. There was apparently a camping limit of 4 weeks. So his group of friends had to actually hide from the rangers because at this point in time, yeah, it was only allowed to camp 4 weeks, and they would actually stay for weeks and weeks longer in the national park. And he spent his time surfing and climbing. And he actually was unhappy with one piece of climbing equipment, which led him to start a company in 1957. But to be honest, a company in this case is a little bit of an exaggeration of the first thing that he had, because what he basically did was hand forging pitons in his parents' backyard and selling them out of the trunk of his car. So, you know what a piton is?
Only because of researching this. I can't imagine ever being the kind of person that uses them.
I have used them, and I'm going to try to explain it, how this thing works, okay? So let me know if I did a good job afterwards. So pitons are used in outdoor climbing. So you start from the bottom as a climber, and you have the rope attached to you, and then you have another person who holds the rope as a belayer. So imagine you're a climber. You climb up, and at some point you want to secure the rope to something, right? Because it doesn't help if your rope is attached to your harness and another person holds it at the bottom. It doesn't help you, right? So at some point in time, you need to secure the rope to the wall. And that's what pitons are for. You use these pitons and you hammer them into the rock. So a piton is basically a nail with an eye hole on the end. So you take a hammer, you drive this piton nail into the rock, and then you clip your rope with a carabiner to this piton, and you can continue climbing. If you fall, you will basically be held by this piton that you drove into the wall. And you repeat this.
Yeah, you have to hammer that in pretty well.
Nowadays in equipped routes, there are pre-screwed nails in there, but this is more the original and very archaic way of first ascending or traditional climbing a route. So you basically use your own equipment to secure yourself. And that's what Yvonne did as like a passion and as a hobby. He loved the untouched outdoors. And he had a problem with the pitons at this time because they were made out of kind of soft steel, which was kind of good because softer things you can more easily drive into rock because it kind of maneuvers its way in there and it's still hard enough to catch you. But the problem with the soft steel is that you can't remove it. So if it's hammered in, you can't remove it, because if you would remove it, then it will break and you cannot hammer it in again. So it's basically a one-time product. You have a piece of steel that you hammer into the rock and then it stays there. First, not very resourceful because you always need to place new gear and you leave it there. Secondly, leave no trace looks differently, right? As soon as you hammer this in, it stays in there. And that's both of this Yvonne was not happy with, right? First, he didn't want to bring as much gear and didn't want to leave it there. And secondly, he didn't want to leave a trace. And this made him do these pitons using hard steel. And these pitons, people could remove after placing them. So if the second person followed the first one, this second person would just remove them from the rock. And they could be used again and again. So see the thought behind that? The very core of Patagonia was being resourceful and creating a product that doesn't leave a trace in nature when climbing. Because the philosophy of Yvonne was, if I was here and I climbed this and the next person will also come here, this person should not know and see any trace of me being there before. Because I want everybody to experience that.
apart from the hole that you made with a Python, right?
Thanks for that, because that's the continuation of the story. Okay, so moving on. This now worked for 10 years. Everybody loved this. His climber friends bought these hand-forged things, but in a way, this was like a makeshift operation. So in 1965, he partnered with his friend Tom Frost and actually founded the company Chouinard Equipment. So they maintained the vision to solve real climbing problems, and they actually reinvented major climbing equipment. I didn't know that, but when I, like, this wasn't even for this research, but I once in a while I read articles of famous climbers to where they share their philosophy of mountaineering, and there I read like a list of equipment that actually Chouinard Equipment reinvented. For example, the ice axe. So the new sport, ice climbing, wouldn't be possible without Yvonne inventing this new tool. And that's, let's say, maybe the most illustrative example, but there is many more examples. And they didn't even stop reinventing when reinventing actually hit themselves. Because as Alan said, after a while, Yvonne started disliking their own pitons because it wasn't actually leave no trace, because it did leave holes. So
didn't align with clean climbing, right? Clean climbing, right? That was the philosophy.
Exactly. And they basically invented something new called chunks. And that's basically just pieces of aluminum that would go into cavities of the rock rather than you would drive them with a hammer into a crack. This means you could also remove them again, but after removing, you wouldn't see a hole. And they announced to end the production of pitons at the stage where 70% of their revenue was pitons.
It's crazy. That tells you a lot about the company. Yeah.
Yeah. Why do you do this? Because you don't like the impact that your product has on the world.
And because you're a reluctant business person. You're not doing it for the business. You're doing it for something else. Yeah.
So this was now already the second step of his business, right? First, it was like makeshift operation, hand forging. Now, this is actually we're talking about the proper business, right? One of the major providers, or I think even the biggest provider of climbing equipment in the US, like climbing hardware in the US. And what they're doing is just disregarding 70% of their revenue because they didn't like the product anymore, because it was doing harm. So you can already see that this is very deeply rooted, this philosophy that you can still feel now in Patagonia. But yeah, the story goes on with this, right? So the trend was only upwards. They also went into clothing, another, not really invention, but basically finding out that rugby shirts with collars have great ability to protect your neck when you have all these heavy climbing gear around your neck. So what they basically did was importing rugby shirts from Scotland, and that's how they went into apparel, because in the very beginning it was only hardware, right? So this is how they went into apparel, because they were like, works for me. I am climbing and I'm happy about the shirt with that is very robust and has a collar, so let's just bring it to the US and sell it there. Yeah, and that's how they started apparel. And at this point, Patagonia did, at this point it wasn't Patagonia actually, at this point it was still Chouinard Equipment. They did great, right? Huge variety of products, climbing hardware, apparel, I think they already started surfing, so different sports, not only climbing. So everything was growing for them, and they were growing like 40% year over year. But things actually turned worse, and you could even say that Murphy's Law struck and almost killed the company. One thing that is the nature of climbing is that it's risky. People get injured. And in 1989, Jenard Equipment actually faced 4 lawsuits where allegedly the injuries were caused by flawed instructions and warnings on the climbing harnesses and other equipment. And actually, this almost killed the company. So Jenard Equipment actually filed for bankruptcy. And in these bankruptcy proceedings, the employees were allowed to acquire the company and establish Black Diamond Equipment. Have you ever heard of Black Diamond?
Yeah.
I own a lot of Black Diamond stuff because my apparel stuff is all still from Adidas. But my hardware, like carabiners, belay devices, like my closet is full of Black Diamond. And I didn't know for a long time that this is actually Patagonia in a way. Because what happened is that, to cope with the shock, Yvonne actually took a trip to Patagonia in South America. So if you don't know this region, please just Google it. It's stunning and one of my dream destinations. I don't know if I will ever get there, but I hope I will. So he went there with some friends, and this trip was truly transformational because one of his friends that came with him, Doug Tompkins, went on to found The North Face, so another outdoor company. And Yvonne decided to sell the clothing items under a separate company, and this is how Patagonia was born. And this also explains why the brand Patagonia is still mostly an apparel company and there is no climbing hardware, because climbing hardware still exists, and that's Black Diamond.
Yeah, they don't sell ropes and carabiners and stuff like that in big volumes. And the logo of Patagonia is a little like outline of the mountain range, right?
Yeah.
Very, very neat. It does look beautiful. I would love to go.
Crazy. It's intercontinental travel, so I don't know. But maybe I will do it again in a while. I have done one last year, so big one. So I'm I owe the planet a little bit, so I will have to wait. I have to wait again for a while before traveling this kind of a distance again. Sounds like crisis averted, right? Unfortunately not. Patagonia was still suffering from the lawsuits. And honestly, also, management wasn't really on top of things at this point in time. So it wasn't only reluctant businessmen, but that's also what they admit. Not great business practices at this point in time, like overburdening stock and not really tightly managing the operations. And in came 1991 recession in the US, really crimping their sales, bank calling in loans to pay off the debts. They actually had to lay off 20% of the workforce, and that is still a shock for them. Like when you read the book of Yvonne and when you read the company story, laying off friends and friends of friends, and I know that like the company being stated as a family and we're all friends, that's not always like, I don't stand behind this philosophy or way of running a business, but apparently that was really the case when they started working together at this point in time. So that was not a great experience for them.
Still apparently is like, this is one of their HR approaches is hire friends.
Really?
Yeah. Well, at this size, it doesn't really work the same way anymore. But back then, it was truly like, if you know anyone, if you know a friend who is interested, just call them in, because they're more likely to be aligned mission-wise to what we're doing.
Yeah. I don't like. We all know that there is goods and bads in this philosophy,
right? Now
it would
be considered nepotism, wouldn't it? and probably not encouraged.
This is always like I have a hard time jumping on either of these sides, because I see the point in hiring friends for a good cause and for a good let's say, philosophy, but I also see the point in hiring for diversity of thought and not only hiring people who have exactly the same philosophy. But I couldn't say, let's only do the one and let's only do the other. And I don't think that this is where we all should be going. But I think we should be aware of the pros and cons of both approaches. And some roles might need this approach and some roles might need a different approach. And that's how I personally see it. But yeah, that's philosophical discussion, which I think we'll have at some point in this podcast.
Not now? Okay.
Let's
I'll wait.
Okay, thanks. So almost bankrupt again, right? And what are they doing again? Go to Patagonia. No joke. So Yvonne packed his top managers and they went to Patagonia again, and basically reflected on the kind of business Patagonia wants to be. And they came back with a strategy that has made Patagonia what it is today. So the mission statement from 1991 is build the best product, cause no unnecessary harm, and use business to inspire and implement solutions to the environmental crisis. Mission statement from 1991 upon returning or being in Patagonia. Yeah, and the rest is basically history. Patagonia grew into the company that Tom pictured for us in the very beginning, and has grown into a brand with one of the largest brand equities I think there is. If you know the brand and if you like are learning about it, it's very hard to at least like not only love it, a lot of people love it, but at least you will remember it and know what it stands for.
Yeah, absolutely. That the equity that it has as a brand is just insane, isn't it? We are going to pick holes in the business for sure and some of the decisions it makes around that mission, but on the surface, as far as like the power of that brand and what it allows and what people make of it, it's extremely strong.
Yeah, true. So what I usually do is think of this strategy playbook, right? What decisions have they actually taken beyond this history overview that we just discussed? What have they done in order to be successful, or maybe what have they also done that wasn't making them successful? And
here it's easy, right? I mean, strategy is simple. As soon as you get into trouble, pack up your things and go to Patagonia. Somehow magically you come back and everything works out.
Yeah, apparently that's
Alan, where are you going to take everyone for, you know, TMBA?
We do on site.
But that, not when, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean things are going fair shapes, but it's thinking of destination.
If you see TMBA team traveling to Patagonia, you know, it's
something's off.
So we call them on-sites because we are a remote company. So when we meet twice a year and this is what we do, then we do it on-site. But that's more like in the middle of where people live rather than on the other side of the
world. You're all fortunate that you live in beautiful, beautiful bits of Europe and the world.
Yeah, a little more people than in Patagonia, but that's okay. I can cope with them at most times.
Yeah. And now let's go to the serious strategy playbook.
Yeah, exactly. So when I wrote this, it almost felt too cheesy. So let me give you like the things that I still think work, and then let's end up with the thing that might be cracking, right? So first one, I think this is one of the companies where you can really see that purpose-driven company performs well. So these three things were so deeply ingrained: building the best product, causing no unnecessary harm and using business to inspire and implement solutions to the environmental crisis. This was so deeply ingrained and also practiced when you do more research that I think that if you have such a strong purpose, it makes your company work better. And it also, they also showed that this was not a one-off, let's write this down and that's it. But there is updates, right? In 2018, where they're saying we're in business to save our home planet. So this kind of a strong mission that is not, and we talk about this later, not only greenwashing, I think is something that can make a company successful, because it leads towards being able to be guided by philosophy instead of rules. So all of a sudden you have a company that works kind of based on a deeper why and a deeper philosophy, and you don't need to have as clear rules because it's more, yeah, it's a deeper thing that guides actions. And you can read that in the book, Let My People Go Surfing. So if you read that, and then if you compare that with actual, let's say, reports of employees and actions of the company, it does match to a big extent. And it also shows by a position they have, which is called Director of Philosophy. Vincent Stanley, he is with the company since 1973, and he is Director of Philosophy. And his job is to not, like, you can have a COO and you can have a process-oriented master of a company, or you can have, and maybe they have both, but still, you can have a Director of Philosophy, which is deeper than optimizing processes, right? Than coming up with rules and then, knowing how to do things right from a process perspective.
Yeah, I've watched a few interviews with him. Interesting chat. Love the fact that they have him and have had him for such a long time.
Like, what is his job? Is his job to make sure that nothing changes?
I think he's just having a big think most days.
Yeah, like, no, but in a way, I think it is his job to make sure he protects the initial philosophy. So I'm being a little bit of chicken tongue, like saying, okay, his job is to make sure nothing changes, but it is in a way.
I would also, I think you can describe it as making sure that the core thing doesn't change.
Yeah.
The purpose. But then I think you can also argue that his job could be to be the forethinker of how this protected purpose is applied to new challenges from a philosophical perspective, right? So I think this is the interesting part, because you have a purpose and a philosophy, but then in come, I don't know, a new climate problem, a new society problem, a new forever chemical that you're actually using as an outdoor company, and then you kind of need to decide how this purpose is now applied to new challenges. And I doubt that he's in every decision, obviously, but I think there is a certain level where this needs discussion, right? So when you are a company, you need to discuss how does your identity and what you want to protect apply to the new world that has definitely changed since you took a decision to write down your fundamental principles. And that's why that a founder can do that, a CEO can do that, or you can have somebody whose job that is. And I think that's the interesting piece in here. Next one, product focus. Again, an obvious one, but I am a deep believer that if you want your company to work, your product needs to be good. And far too often, that's not the case. Like, far too often, I'm using products and I'm getting sold products that don't work or that don't last long enough. And I think this is what they have been consistently doing, creating the best product, or at least trying to create the best product, and at least thinking about how this can be better. So I'm not, so this is always really dangerous when we talk about these companies. I'm not trying to say that they have succeeded at all of this. And I'm not saying they always have the best product and nothing breaks and everything's perfect. I'm more trying to say that I see a sincere effort.
Mm. Yeah.
To doing this.
And a best product with their philosophy could mean if it breaks, you can fix it at least, right? Like, that's fine. It can not last forever, but the repairability being baked in. So I think that's okay if they're living that part of the philosophy as well.
Yeah. And I've owned too many backpacks that I loved and were great products. And then one clip broke and it's unusable because you can't repair the clip. Then you need to change your backpack because the one plastic thing that will eventually break has broken.
Yeah. I've got a North Face, ironically, backpack, which amazing, but can't replace the zip. So it's useless.
Yeah. Next one, sales strategy. Interesting one, because I think the train that they drove there was scarcity. Again, maybe now not as much anymore, right? They are a $1 billion company, but from the very start, they started with a mail order catalog that Alan already brought up. Direct sales. From the very start, they did direct sales also in their own brand stores and small specialty retailers. And they did that for a long time and it almost killed them because it's a worse cost structure than if you go to like the broad range of retailers. But still, what you can do is have very close contact with your users and control the story that people see and experience. Now, obviously, they are very close to everybody else, to be honest, right? Omnichannel, online shop, retailers. But still, there is the nuance that lives on with still running own stores that sometimes act as community centers with a lot of workshops and community events, more carefully selecting retailers and wholesalers based on certain criteria. And for example, also limiting co-branding of their tech Pro vests. And apparently they actually really had to do this because they just were not happy about the companies that put their logo on their Patagonia vest. And they started to raid them and prohibit companies that are not aligned with their values to put their logo on their vest, which was a reaction to everybody in finance and everybody in tech using this to maybe even greenwash themselves. And so that also plays into scarcity, right? You're saying, well, nope, you cannot buy this. Sorry, Tom, I cut you off.
I was going to say, so many of these finance companies invest in or take funding from like fossil fuels companies and companies with poor labor laws and stuff. So yeah, they absolutely doubled down on that angle. But they were inundated, weren't they? When it became a real fashion item, they were getting hundreds of requests a day for this co-branding stuff. So I think regardless of the fact that ethically they went down the route of saying no, they just couldn't keep up with the demand either. So
yeah,
it was a problem they needed to fix.
True. Last one, last strategic decision, marketing strategy. The way they do marketing is very special because they basically only do two kinds of marketing, which is either activism or education. So activism is for them a very big part of marketing. You could also say they do activism for the sake of activism, which is definitely also true, but their activism is marketing. For example, when the US government announced a plan to cut back protected areas and open them for mining and development, Patagonia actually sued the government and highly invested in lobbying and organized protests. And obviously, this is great marketing, but you can get marketing cheaper, right? So you don't have to like hire a gang of lawyers to sue the US government. You can also, I don't know, buy an ad that says, don't do that, right? So it is definitely marketing, but it is activism. They do something that is changing, moving something, or at least attempts to do it, because the bill still went through. In this case, at least. Education is the next one. So whenever there, a lot of their ads are actually educating ads. For example, their Black Friday ad, where they said, don't buy this jacket on top and in the bottom, it taught users the environmental impact of this jacket. And now is where we need to have the philosophical discussion, because this is also where it cracks, right? Don't buy this jacket with education that this is all bad, basically led to sales increase of 30%. So the more they tell people to not buy this, like paint themselves a sustainable anti-consumerism and telling people that this is all bad, the bigger the brand value gets, the more drive towards the brand is, and actually the more things they sell. And you started with this, Tom, the more stuff they sell, which means resources again. So here is where the critics come in and say, well, I mean, you're just as bad at every other company because you're only, again, selling us stuff. And the best thing is you wouldn't. Like, if you want to be sustainable, then close shop, right? So you're participating in the same thing.
Yeah, it's a very, there are so many philosophical angles on this and practical ones as well. And yeah, the fact that their sales went up 30% off the back of that, it's like, oh, damn. Like, cynically, you could think, was that the intention? I don't think it probably was. I think it probably came from the right place. What I would say in defense of, okay, there was a sales jump and they're putting things into the world. When it comes to sustainability, there's a fair body of evidence that product longevity trumps so many like eco initiatives. And Bellroy have got really interesting like blog posts around this, and they have one specifically about Patagonia's ways of doing that. Like, okay, there was a boost in people buying jackets that probably needed a jacket that bought them on that Black Friday. Those jackets might last 10 times as long as the alternative they might have bought. So, you know, it's so hard to quantify because we can't kind of track all of these different elements together. But I think if you're putting a product in the world that genuinely can last many, 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 many times longer than something else, then that is a net good. But ultimately, we don't know. Someone might be replacing that a year later because their philosophy is around fashion. But yeah, interesting one. Not the only dimension where Patagonia quite rightly still get criticized when it comes to saying one thing and doing another.
What's your take on this, Alan?
Tough one. It kind of reminds me of pharmaceutical companies where their approach to things is like, oh, we have a cure to this, so we need to tell everyone that we've figured out this huge... We have this huge innovation is going to help you out. Even if there's some downsides to it, don't worry, like it's still going to help you. And I'll find and manipulate you into buying this because I know if I manipulate you, this is going to be in the end good for you. So I'm not really manipulating you. I'm just helping you take the right decision. And this is not just pharma, by the way. This is like a lot of other industries who behave this way. So it kind of reminds me of this, like, don't buy this jacket, but I'm basically telling you, buy this jacket.
If you buy a jacket, then buy this jacket.
Yeah, exactly. Because it's so much better than the other jackets. Yeah. I'm just packaging it into a much nicer message. But at the same time, because I know so much about this company, I feel uneasy putting them in the same bucket with this other. So I don't know. I'm torn and I feel like I don't have a good opinion on this. But for some reason, I wouldn't fully criticize them because I think every company is in business and needs to sell stuff, needs to sell something, otherwise it won't survive, needs to offer something, otherwise it won't be able to afford salaries and everything else. So it's just like, yeah. Where is the line?
I also always get uneasy when people say, well, if you want to be sustainable, you need to close down because you're still selling the same stuff. And that's all true, right? They are using products that use fossil fuels, and there are still some forever chemicals, and there is still like Patagonia is still not bad. Like, not having Patagonia would still have less impact than Patagonia as it is right now. But then in this case, I'm not with the people that say you need to close down as a company and you're just like greenwashing, because I would rather say that if we want less impact, we need to stop buying. And as long as there is people buying, then they should rather buy from companies like Patagonia. And then I'm not on the side of saying, well, let's just like, yeah, we can also say, let's just move back to our caves and tents and grow our food and everything ourselves.
But even then we were buying stuff or like, you know, exchanging things. You know, exactly. I would have a chicken, you would have a goat, and I would give you 10 chickens for a goat or whatever, you know, like, so it is, I think it goes much deeper.
And I'm still waiting to learn about the very first blunt lie from Patagonia, right? Because what I'm seeing is that they do make mistakes, but they admit it. Yeah. And I'm also seeing that they do have good initiatives, like 1996, changing to 100% organic cotton, which again, very likely has its own problems, but still better than the other option. Or, I don't know, Worn Wear Program. Political action, 1% initiative. They started in 1985 to pledge 1% of their sales, not profit, sales, to environmental programs. So the track record is still there. And I'm definitely sure they're making mistakes. And if somebody comes to me and shows me that they have actually lied to me and are dumping their chemicals into the water without trying to make it at least as unimpactful as possible, then as long as I'm actually for running companies the way Patagonia runs them. And that actually brings me to my very last point, which is, it's not really a strategic decision, but also it is a strategic decision. That all is only possible if you're a private company. Like, you can only do that stuff and almost go bankrupt because you're, I don't know, having too much cost in your product, pledge this money, invest in this, have a stance as a company that throws off many people and loses a lot of business because you take one or the other side. And you can only do this if you're a private company.
Yeah. And I'll talk a lot about this in the next section.
Cool.
Yeah. Because, I mean, it is interesting because Patagonia is a private company, but it's one of those companies that's also not private. So if you read the book, Let My People Go Surfing, one of the first things you see in the financial philosophy chapter is this quote. Who are businesses really responsible to? Their customers, shareholders, employees? Well, we would argue that it's none of the above. Fundamentally, businesses are responsible to their resource base. Without a healthy environment, there are no shareholders, no employees, no customers, and no business. Drastically different mission statement to almost any other company out there. So you have companies who are being seen as very progressive because they put their employees as the main stakeholder, because they put their customers as their main stakeholder. But Patagonia goes even a step further with Earth is our main stakeholder. So in a way, it's a private company, but it almost behaves like a nonprofit, which actually now partially is, but I'll come to this. And as you said, Franz, earlier, so Patagonia says that they are a product-driven company. And you might say, you listener, is like, yeah, but not are not all companies product-driven or service-driven companies? You know, everybody's selling something. But the way to think about it is that public companies, their biggest product is the company itself. So the CEO of a public company has more interest in raising the price of the company than improving the product itself, because their incentives, their salary, if they will keep the job or not, is more tied to the share price, which is the worth or the value of the company. And so this is actually a pretty interesting distinction. So Patagonia being a product-driven company and not being a public company, which is more like a company that is just trying to sell itself in a way. So that's really important for their financials, because that really plays out into how they behave and how they do their business. By the way, I don't have that many numbers this time because company is private. So there isn't a lot of things available. I do have a few numbers later, but I do want to share a little bit more about their financial philosophy, which I think is the most interesting bit here. So as we've seen, Patagonia's mission says nothing about the profit. Almost no company puts the profit in their mission, despite that actually being their mission, because they're public companies. But yeah, what the Chouinard family says is that they basically consider their bottom line, which is another word for profit. So they consider bottom line to be the amount of good that the business or the company accomplishes over the year. That's how they look at the profit. But at the same time, they know they have to stay and be profitable in order to accomplish all of their goals. But at the same time, because they want to be seen as an example of how you can run a company differently, they know the respect they're looking for can only be received if they're profitable. Because no other company will look at them and try to copy and mimic and try to become more responsible and more ethical if they don't see that Patagonia, who is the most progressive one, or one of the most progressive ones in this space, that it's not having success. So there's a lot of burden on Patagonia to do good, but also be a good business, because that is the best story we can tell. The best story we can tell for this business ecosystem and for what kind of companies we should be building. But how does the company do it? So there are three things I want to talk about. One is the natural growth. The second one is no debt. And the third one is staying private. And I think, Franz, you talked a little bit about staying private. But the reason this is so important is because, there is no pressure from the outside world, which means you don't have any investors that you need to report to. You don't have any stockholders who are daily being able to sell your stock or buy it and trade it, which creates a lot of pressure on the company, which means you can think and you can invest long-term. You can take certain unpopular decisions, even if there's some backlash. You know, it's a family business, it's a private business. Actually, it's not a business anymore, it's a nonprofit, but I'll get to this. But yeah, it just has a different you running a company. You can have a different lens. You can take different decisions. You can try unconventional things. And one of those things, so even if they're private, additional thing that they do is that they try to have no debt. That's very, very drastic, because most companies, even very, very successful ones, have debt, because in certain ways it's cheaper to have debt than to finance with your own cash. That's a completely different discussion that we shouldn't be having now. Yeah. But
how does debt help you reduce your taxes?
Exactly. But yeah, let's just say that sometimes taking a debt is cheaper for a company than paying with the cash they have in a bank. But the reason Chouinard family has decided to have no debt is exactly for this whole reason, is because once you have creditors, once you have banks, once you have also investors, there's the pressure that comes with this debt. And you want to be self-reliant. You want to be free from that pressure to take unpopular decisions. So, and I really love these two examples. So staying private and Node Debt as an example of how all of this is reinforced together. You know, strategy is not just like, oh, Patagonia creates the best products. Oh, or they have great marketing. Like all of these things, even financial decisions of how the companies run work together to enable this. And that's for me, the big lesson, like in all of our teardowns is like, if you look at any singular individual decision, strategic one, it seems like, yeah, that's easy. I can do this, but it's not easy because there's so many interconnected decisions. And as soon as you are a VC-backed startup, there's a whole lot of things you cannot do because of the decision, or vice versa. As soon as you're private and bootstrapped, there's a whole lot of things you cannot do versus the VC-backed startups. And the last thing that is really interesting in the financial philosophy for Patagonia, and you touched upon this, Franz, with you call this scarcity. They call it natural growth. And what this means is that they are not artificially trying to create demand apart from the Black Friday ad that they put out and activism. Yeah, so there's, there is this fine line and silver lining there. But so they call it natural growth, which means they don't have these very aggressive, ambitious goals. Oh, we need to grow by 20% this year. So they more rely on the customers to tell them when to grow. So what they say is that, and I'm quoting now, when our customers tell us that they're frustrated by not being able to buy our product because of constant out-of-stock situation, then we make more. We want customers who need our clothing, not just desire it. It's a very beautiful line, reads very well, but it's a really also interesting way to think about the growth. It's
growth goals, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the huge... A lot of us have experienced that when working in companies, that in 1 year, everything is perfect, right? You're growing, everything is good, you meet your goals, everybody's happy. In the next year, it's like everything is bad because we haven't reached our growth goal. But we have actually done very good work in both of these years.
Yeah.
So, and the only one who is unhappy is the person who wanted the growth in the first place, is paid by reaching the goal or not reaching the goal, because the company is healthy in any case. If you get the 8% growth or the 6 or the 4 or the 12, the company is going to live.
There's an argument to be made that if not growing at the pace of inflation, that you're actually declining. But in general, I do think that sometimes those growth goals are just overblown, and the whole morale in the team is low just because you're not reaching certain arbitrary goals.
Yeah. And if your growth goal needs to be met because you need the funds in order to invest in the next cool thing, obviously your company can die if you don't reach this growth goal. Right. But in what I'm more referring to is these cases where we feel like the growth goals are for the sake of it.
Yeah.
And I guess many of us and also listeners have been in companies where we feel like, I don't know, I don't see the point in this exact growth goal, because if we reach it or not, we're all going to be fine, but still something seems to be off.
Right. Yeah. So this is all well and nice, but we still want to see some numbers, right, Tom?
Yes.
Love a number. I imagine they'd be quite big.
So the financials that we have is that Patagonia is doing roughly 1 billion in revenue with 10% profit margin. So that's 100 million in profit. So pretty healthy, pretty big. But how does it stack against some of the other companies in this same space? So I was trying to have a look at the two other basically direct competitors who are publicly traded. So one of them is called Columbia Sportswear. I'm sure both of you are familiar with it. So we're going to play a little bit of the guessing game. So the question is just, which company is more valuable? Is it Patagonia or Columbia Sportswear?
I'm going to say Colombia just because I think it's probably more broad, slightly cheaper as well, I think. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would love to say, no, I also think it's Colombia.
Yeah, and you're both right. So Yvonne basically shared that he thinks Patagonia is worth around $3 billion. And if that's true, then Colombia with $4.5 billion in value is worth more. But then we have a slightly more, I mean, interesting and complicated one, because there is a holding company called VFC who owns North Face, Timberland, Supreme, and some other brands, and they're also publicly traded. In this case, what do you think, which one is bigger, Patagonia or the corporation owning a lot of different brands in the same space?
I think surely it's that the latter.
Mm-hmm. I also think so.
Yeah, it is, but I was just surprised by how little. So it's $3 billion of Patagonia versus $5 billion of VFC, the market cap, which includes their biggest competitor, North Face, Timberland, and some other smaller ones. So that was surprising to me. But maybe this is also not true, because Patagonia could easily be worth more, because as we said before, it doesn't have any debt. It has a lot of cash in the cash reserves, and that's usually the things investors value. But yeah, Patagonia is not for sale, because it's not a private company anymore in a way. It's basically a non-profit. So a couple of years ago, the founder, Yvonne, decided to give the company to a non-profit. And so the way it works is the family still owns the voting stock. So basically they own 2% of the company, but they own all the voting stocks, which means they can take all decisions within the company. But the nonprofit owns 98% of the company, but has no voting rights. What that means is I basically make all decisions about this company. And if there's any profit and if there's any value left, the nonprofit gets basically all the value at the end of the year. And this means that, yeah, I think it's a really interesting case of how to construct a privately held company where you do want to disincentivize yourself from creating maybe certain or taking certain decisions that could be too, I don't know, exploitative, because you don't benefit directly from them. You know, you are just basically putting in this bucket, you're putting in this organization, you're putting the money into a nonprofit, which then hopefully can use this money to do good for, as Patagonia says, the resource base of the company, which in this case, and yeah, in all cases, is our earth, basically. Yeah. So I think that's basically the kind of how it all ties together. So it started as a private company. It took a lot of different decisions. Some of them, I mean, it was like a progression even in the company. So first they created 1 Pitons, then they realized that it has an issue. And I think they went from like this product level innovation in terms of how to do good for the world, all the way to how to structure the company differently in order to even prevent themselves from doing bad directly.
Yeah. And one thing that I now find actually interesting, and one can also now hold for Patagonia, is their profit margins. So, I don't have this anywhere. But do you remember Lululemon?
Their profit margin?
Sales.
I can have a look. Lululemon. Revenue, $9 billion.
Mm-hmm. And we don't have gross profit margins, right? For
gross profit margin Q3 of 2023.
No, for Patagonia.
Patagonia, no.
Okay. But you said 10% net profit margin, yeah. For... And Lululemon has?
Let me see. So what is that? No, still not there.
Net profit margin 20. 21% net profit margin of Lululemon.
Okay. 21.
So usually we praise high profit margins, right?
Yeah.
So we say, hey, Aesop, awesome, 80% profit margin. Which is true, right?
Yeah.
Because people pay it, and if it's a luxury product, also makes sense, right? But you could also argue, well, dear company, what are you doing with your money? Couldn't you spend it more wisely? Especially I'm now talking about net profit margin, not gross profit margin, right? So the net profit margin is the one that actually is the profit of the company. And when you compare Lululemon in a similar business with a similar mission, not as fierce as Patagonia, not as true as Patagonia maybe, and they have the double net profit margin, that means to me that Patagonia is investing. And this could be worse management, but this can also be we're investing more in our products, or we're investing more in our social or environmental activism. I didn't do research into that, but for me, it was just interesting as a data point that, because if I saw now that Lululemon had 20% net profit margin and Patagonia had 30, then I would have been, there's a crack in this story, right? You're still earning a shitload of money. But now I see that actually also this net profit margin is lower. So it just supports the story.
But in a way, I think this is also wrong. Like, why would we, like, if Patagonia was more profitable than Lululemon, why would be people like, oh, I don't trust you anymore? If it's even more profitable, it can do even more. It can invest even more into these activist things. So I personally wouldn't hold it against them. I would be even more impressed.
That depends on where this
exactly
where but this cost know. Comes in, right?
But we won't know. Are because you... it's private. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Is this cost going towards the net margin, or is this cost actually then after the profit?
Maybe.
But this is now a little bit nerding that we're doing.
But I think I know the reason why Lululemon is more profitable than Patagonia. It's because of all of those trips to Patagonia. Every time they need to figure out something.
A lot of people to take out there now. Also, I think if the philosophy is to have products that last longer, more of them in the world, like it's a luxury to be able to afford Patagonia. Or to be honest, most brands that make things that last a long time. So I think that would be at odds with that mission to suddenly raise like the profit margin, because that would mean you are probably charging more than you need to, and let's try and make it as affordable as you can for as many people to be able to have those products that can last a long time, because the majority of people can't afford that, which is where they end up gravitating towards fast fashion.
That's why 3 out of 5 of my Patagonia products are caps, not expensive.
yeah.
But
good thought here.
Yeah.
I agree.
So I think now that we learned all this about the company, it's time to go into our last bit, which is how do we feel about this company? Buy, hold, sell. As always, not an investment advice, especially here because you cannot buy stocks and trade stocks of Patagonia. But this is just more about our feeling towards the future outlook of this company. So is it more positive? Is it more neutral or more negative? Maybe let's start with you, Franz.
Here I have big trouble looking at this from a rational point of view, to be honest. Because, I don't own any Patagonia products, but I do admire how this company is run. So this is why I would just like it and the way they practice business. So that's why I want to say, of course, I want to invest, because you should give money where you think the money is used wisely. And looking at this from a purely financial perspective, now that we've learned there is 10% gross profit, net profit margin, it's not the best dividend business that you can buy. So that wouldn't speak for buying. Also growth potential. I just compared it also with some other brands in the outdoor space that I know. Patagonia is already huge compared to other outdoor brands. So yeah, also growth potential is not as, I don't know, I wouldn't say it's huge. So I think it's not a buy for me from a business perspective.
So.
Hard to be objective, like Fran said. And if I was taking the Yvonne Chouinard rethink on what, you know, usually it's investing because of you want to profit, right? That's why most of us buy shares in something. So I'm going to say in this instance, I'm going to put that to one side and say I would absolutely be buying because I would make a bit of money off the top of that, but I would feel, I'd have a warm fuzzy feeling. I'm supporting a company that is trying to create a better world, but also set a better example. So my dividends would come in a different form. And I think Yvonne would probably align with that. So it would be a buy from me.
Yeah, I think I will also put that part of my investment money into it, that the feel good part of the investment money. So not like, oh, I really expect this to grow by a lot and hopefully help me retain my purchasing power and so on. But it's just more like, yeah, that's the certain portion that just makes you feel good about the things you're doing. In a funny way, I do think this would be a great investment. So buying Patagonia, and that's why the company is getting so many offers from the private equity companies, because all of them see a huge potential in optimizing this machine, or in brackets, exploiting this brand, which could work in the short term. So I think in a way it's a great buy, but also if it would be run, and if it is run the way it's run right now for the like, I don't know, 10, 20, 30, 40 years, then it's financially looking probably not the best investment, but it is a solid like investment for good sleep, stable.
And that's a crazy thing in itself, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
What a company.
Yes. Yeah. Quite a story. Quite a story. Mm. Yeah, I don't have anything else. Do you two have any other notes that you didn't touch upon?
Nah. Many thoughts around how business is done in general.
Yeah.
Whenever I research such companies and whenever I get into thinking of capitalism and also this that we just discussed in terms of, well, I wouldn't invest my money there because it doesn't make me money. Why doesn't it make me money? Because it's a company that is run better. So I'm going to invest my money that I want to bring me return into worse companies. So all of this wrecks my brain. So I think this is a philosophy podcast that we could be having, but I'm maybe not the best person to explain my thoughts concisely on this.
No, but I think you
that's what
perfectly solved it. But it's all like macroeconomics, so we would have to go into capitalism and all these things. So yeah, you do get into a denial of the idea itself in a way.
Yeah.
But that's why it's so fascinating.
Mm. I had lots more notes, but I'm going to spare our audience those because I think they're not well formed. But I would encourage all our listeners to dive a little more into the story and learn from it. And I'm finally going to actually get further with this book off the back of this. So yeah, very inspired by it all.
And if you enjoyed this episode, don't just pick up the book, but also pick up our mini MBA, which is the free 7-day email course for all designers interested in learning business topics. So you can find that at d.mba/mini-mba. So yeah, you can just type in your email, sign up, and you'll receive 7 emails over the course of 7 days, each of them teaching you one business concept relevant for designers. So that is indeed everything in this one, and see you in the next episode. Bye, Franz. Bye, Tom.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.